Was even that government tiring of the struggle? It was easy to call that an impossibility, but that word no longer had its prior meaning. 5 kilometers outside Damascus, he spotted the other car waiting at the prescribed place. He drove past it for 2,000 meters, scanning for surveillance before he decided it was safe to turn around. A minute later, he pulled over close to it. The 2 men got out as they'd been directed to do, and their driver, a member of the organization, simply drove away.
Good morning, Gunther.
And to you, Ibrahim. This is my friend Manfred. Both men got into the back of the car, and the engineer drove off at once. Gon eyed the newcomer in the mirror. Older than Bach, thinner, with deep-sunk eyes. He was poorly dressed for the environment and sweating like a pig. Ibrahim handed back a plastic water bottle. The newcomer wiped off the top with his handkerchief before drinking.
Arabs not sanitary enough for you? Gon wondered.
Well, that was not his concern, was it? The drive to the new location took 2 hours. Gon deliberately took a circuitous route despite the fact that the sun would keep a careful observer informed of their direction. He didn't know what sort of training this Manfred fellow had, and while it was prudent to assume he knew every skill there was, it was also prudent to employ every trick in the book. By the time they arrived at their destination, only a trained reconnaissance soldier would have been able to duplicate the route. Kati had chosen well. Until a few months earlier, it had been a command center for the Hezbollah. Dug into the side of a steep hillside, the corrugated iron roof was covered with earth and planted with the sparse local shrubbery. Only a skilled man who knew exactly what he was looking for could ever have spotted it, and that was unlikely. Hezbollah was particularly adept at routing out informers in its midst. A dirt track ran right past it to an abandoned farm whose land was too played out even for opium and hashish production, which was the major cash crop in the area. Inside the structure was about 100 square meters of concrete-floored shade, even with room to park a few vehicles. The only bad news was that this place would be a death trap in case of an earthquake, Gon told himself. Not an unknown occurrence in the region. He pulled the car in between 2 posts, out of sight. On leaving the car, he dropped camouflage netting behind it. Yes, Kati had chosen well. The hardest balance, as always, was choosing between the 2 aspects of security. On the one hand, the more people who knew anything was happening, the worse it was. On the other, some people were necessary just to provide a guard force. Kati had brought most of his personal guard, 10 men of known loyalty and skill. They knew Gon and Bach by sight, and their leader came forward to meet Manfred. "This is our new friend," Gon told the man, who looked closely at the German's face and walked away.
"Was gibt's ihr?" Fromm asked, in tense German. "What we have here," Gon answered in English, "is very interesting."
Manfred took his lesson from that.
"Kommen Sie mit, bitte."
Gon led them to a wall with a door in it. A man with a rifle stood outside of it, which made much better sense than a lock. The engineer nodded to the guard, who nodded curtly back. Gon led them into the room and pulled a cord to turn on the fluorescent lighting. There was a large metal work table covered with a tarp. Gon removed the tarp without further comment. He was tiring of the drama in any case. It was time for real work.
Gott im Himmel!
"I've never seen it myself," Bach admitted. "So that is what it looks like."
Fromm put on some glasses and peered over the mechanism for perhaps a minute before looking up.
"American design, but not American manufacture," he pointed. "Wrong sort of wiring. Crude device, 30 years. No, older than that in design, but not in fabrication. These circuit boards are 1960s, perhaps early 70s. Soviet? From the cache in Azerbaijan, perhaps?"
Gon merely shook his head.
"Israeli? Ist das möglich?"
That question got a nod.
"More than possible, my friend. It is here."
"Gravity bomb. Tritium injection into the pit to boost yield. 50 to 70 kilotons, I'd guess.
radar und impact fusing. It has actually been dropped, but did not go off. Why?
Apparently it was never armed. Everything we recovered is before you, Gon answered. He was already impressed with Manfred.
Frome ran his fingers inside the bomb case, searching for connectors.
You are correct. How interesting.
There was a long pause.
You know that it can probably be repaired.
And even...
Even what? Gon asked, knowing the answer.
This design can be converted into a triggering device.
For what? Bach asked.
For a hydrogen bomb, Gon answered. I suspected that.
Awfully heavy. Nothing like the efficiency of a modern design. As they say, crude but effective.
Frome looked up.
You want my help to repair it, then?
Will you help? Gon asked.
10 years. More. 20 years I have studied and thought. How will it be used?
Does that trouble you?
It will not be used in Germany.
Of course not, Gon answered almost in annoyance.
What quarrel did the organization really have with the Germans after all? Something in Bach's mind, however, went click. He closed his eyes for a moment to engrave the thought in his memory.
Yes, I will help.
You will be well paid,
Gon promised him. He saw a moment later that this was a mistake. But that didn't matter, did it?
I do not do such things for money. You think I am a mercenary?
Frome asked indignantly.
Excuse me, I meant no insult. A skilled worker is someone to be rewarded for his time. We are not beggars, you know.
Neither am I,
Frome almost said before his good sense intervened. These were not the Argentines, were they? They were not fascists, not capitalists. They were revolutionary comrades who had also fallen upon bad political times, though he was sure their fiscal situation was highly favorable indeed. The Soviets had never given arms to the Arabs. It had all been sold for hard currency, even under Brezhnev and Andropov. And if that had been good enough for the Soviets when they still held the true faith, then...
Forgive me. I merely stated a fact, and I did not mean to insult you either. I know you are not beggars. You are revolutionary soldiers, freedom fighters, and I will be honored to assist you in any way I can.
He waved his hand.
You may feel free to pay me whatever you think fair.
It would be plenty, more than a mere million D-mark.
But please understand that I do not sell myself for money.
It is a pleasure to meet an honorable man, Gon said with a satisfied look.
Bach thought they had both laid it on rather thick, but kept his peace. He already suspected how Frome would be paid.
So, Gon said next, where do we begin?
First, to think.
I need paper and a pencil.
And who might you be? Ryan asked.
Ben Goodley, sir.
Boston? Ryan asked. The accent was quite distinctive.
Yes, sir. Kennedy School. I'm a postdoctoral fellow and, well, now I'm a White House fellow also.
Nancy? Ryan turned to his secretary.
The director has him on your calendar, Dr. Ryan.
Okay, Dr. Goodley, Ryan said with a smile. Come on in. Clark took his seat after sizing the new guy up. Want some coffee?
You have decaf? Goodley asked.
You want to work here, boy. You'd better get used to the real stuff. Grab a seat. Sure you don't want any?
I'll pass, sir.
Okay. Ryan poured his customary mug and sat down behind his desk.
So what are you doing in this puzzle palace?
The short version is, looking for a job. I did my dissertation on intelligence operations, their history and prospects. I need to see some things to finish my work at Kennedy, Then I want to find out if I can do the real thing. Jack nodded. That sounded familiar enough. Clearances. TS, SAP, SAR. Those are new. I already had a secret because some of my work at Kennedy involved going into some presidential archives, mainly in D.C., but some of the stuff in Boston is still sensitive. I even was part of the team that FOI'd a lot of stuff from the Cuban Missile Crisis. Dr. Nicholas Bledsoe? His work? That's right. I didn't buy all of Nick's conclusions, but that was a hell of a piece of research. Jack raised his mug in salute. Goodley had written nearly half of that monograph, including the conclusions. What did you take issue with, if I may ask? Khrushchev's action was fundamentally irrational. I think, and the record bears this out, that his placing the missiles there was impulsive rather than reasoned. I disagree. The paper pointed out that the principal Soviet concern was our IRBMs in Europe, especially the ones in Turkey. It seems logical to conclude that it was all a ploy to reach a stable situation regarding theater forces. Your paper didn't report on everything, Jack said. Such as? Goodley asked, hiding his annoyance. Such as the intel we were getting from Penkovsky and others. Those documents are still classified and will remain so for another 20 years. Isn't 50 years a long time? Sure is, Ryan agreed. But there's a reason. Some of that information is still, well, not exactly current, but it would reveal some tricks we don't want revealed. Isn't that just a little extreme? Goodley asked as dispassionately as he could manage. Let's say we had Agent Banana operating back then. Okay, he's dead now. Died of old age, say, but maybe Agent Pear was recruited by him, and he's still working. If the Sobes find out who Banana was, that might give them a clue. Also, you have to think about certain methods of message transfer. People have been playing baseball for 150 years, but a change-up is still a change-up. I used to think the same way you do, Ben. You learn that most of the things that are done here are done for a reason. Captured by the system, Goodley thought. By the way, you did notice that Khrushchev's last batch of tapes pretty much proved Nick Bledsoe wrong on some of his points. One other thing. Yes? Let's say that John Kennedy had hard intel in the spring of 1961, really good stuff that Khrushchev wanted to change the system. In 58, he'd effectively gutted the Red Army, and he was trying to reform the party. Let's say that Kennedy had hard stuff on that, and he was told by a little bird that if he cut the Ruskies a little slack, maybe we could have had a rapprochement in the 60s. Glasnost, say, 30 years early. Let's say all that happened, and the president blew the call, decided for political reasons that it was disadvantageous to cut Nikita a little slack. That would mean that the 1960s were all a great big mistake. Vietnam, everything, all a gigantic screw-up. I don't believe it. I've been through the archives. It's not consistent with everything we know about consistency in a politician, Ryan interrupted. There's a revolutionary concept. If you're saying that really happened, it was a hypothetical, Jack said with a raised eyebrow. Hell, he thought. The information was all out there for anyone who wanted to pull it together. That it had never been done was just another manifestation of a wider and more troubling problem. But the part that worried him was right in this building. He'd leave history to historians. Until, someday, he decided to rejoin their professional ranks. And when will that be, Jack? Nobody'd ever believe it. Most people believe that Lyndon Johnson lost the New Hampshire primary to Eugene McCarthy because of the Tet Offensive, too. Welcome to the world of intelligence, Dr. Goodley. You know what's the hardest part of recognizing the truth? Jack asked. What's that? Knowing that something just bit you on the ass. It's not as easy as you think. And the breakup of the Warsaw Pact. Case in point, Ryan agreed. We had all kinds of indicators, and we all blew the call.
Well, that's not true exactly. A lot of the youngsters in the DI, Directorate of Intelligence, Jack explained unnecessarily, which struck Goodley as patronizing, were making noise, but the section chiefs pooh-poohed it. And you, sir?
If the director's agreeable, we can let you see some of that. Most of it, in fact.
The majority of our agents and field officers got faked out of their jockstraps, too. We all could have done better, and that's as true of me as it is of anybody else. If I have a weakness, it's that I have too tactical a focus. Trees instead of the forest?
Yep,
Ryan admitted. That's the big trap here. But knowing about it doesn't always help a whole hell of a lot.
I guess that's why they sent me over, Goodley observed.
Jack grinned. Hell, that's not terribly different from how I got started here. Welcome aboard. Where do you want to start, Dr. Goodley?
Ben already had a good idea on that, of course. If Ryan could not see it coming, that was not his problem, was it?
So where do you get the computers? Bach asked.
Fromm was closeted away with his paper and pencils.
Israel for a start. Maybe Jordan or Turkey, Gon replied.
This will be rather expensive, Bach warned.
I have already checked out the computer-controlled machine tools.
Yes, they are expensive.
But not that expensive.
It occurred to Gon that he had access to hard currency assets that might boggle the mind of this unbeliever.
We will see what your friend requires. Whatever it is, we will get it.
Chapter 13. Process.
Why did I ever accept this job?
Roger Durling was a proud man. The upset winner of what was supposed to have been a secure Senate seat, then the youngest governor in the history of California, he knew pride to be a weakness, but he also knew that there was much to justify his. I could have waited a few years, maybe returned to the Senate and earned my way into the White House instead of cutting a deal and delivering the election to Fowler. In return for this. This was Air Force Two, the radio call sign for whatever aircraft the vice president rode on. The implicit contrast with Air Force One made just one more joke that attached to what was putatively the second most important political post in the United States, though not as earthily apt as John Nance Garner's observation, a pitcher of warm spit. The whole office of vice president, Durling judged, was one of the few mistakes made by the founding fathers. It had once been worse. Originally, the vice president was supposed to have been the losing candidate who, after losing, would patriotically take his place in a government not his and preside over the Senate, setting aside petty political differences to serve the country. How James Madison had ever been that foolish was something scholars had never really examined, but the mistake had been corrected quickly enough by the 12th Amendment in 1803. Even in an age when gentlemen preparing for a duel referred to each other as sir, that was something that pressed selflessness too far. And so the law had been changed, and the vice president was now an appendage instead of a defeated enemy. That so many vice presidents had succeeded to the top job was less a matter of design than happenstance. That so many had done well, Andrew Johnson, Theodore Roosevelt, Harry Truman, was miraculous. It was in any case a chance he would never have. Bob Fowler was physically healthy and politically as secure as any president had been since Eisenhower, Durling wondered. Maybe even FDR. The important, almost co-equal role for the vice president that Carter had initiated with Walter Mondale, something largely ignored but highly constructive, was a thing of the past. Fowler did not need Durling anymore. The president had made that quite clear. And so Durling was relegated to subsidiary, not even secondary, duties. Fowler got to fly about in a converted 747 dedicated to his use alone. Roger Durling got whatever aircraft might be available, in this case one of the VC-20B Gulfstreams that were used by anyone who had the right credentials.
Senators and House members on junkets got them if they were on the right committees, or if the President sensed a need to stroke their egos. You're being petty, Durling told himself. By being petty, you justify all the crap you have to put up with.
His misjudgment had been at least as great as Madison's, the Vice President told himself as the aircraft taxied out. In deciding that a political figure would place country above his own ambition, Madison had merely been optimistic. Durling, on the other hand, had ignored an evident political reality, that the real difference in importance between president and vice president was far greater than the difference between Fowler and any of a dozen committee chairmen in the House or Senate. The president had to deal with Congress to get any work done. He didn't need to deal with his vice president. How had he allowed himself to get here?
That earned an amused grunt, though the question had occurred to Durling 1,000 times. Patriotism, of course, or at least the political version of it. He'd delivered California, and without California he and Fowler would both still be governors. The one substantive concession he'd gotten, the accession of Charlie Alden to the post of National Security Advisor, had been for naught. But he had been the deciding factor in changing the presidency from one party to another. And his reward for that was drawing every crap detail in the executive branch, delivering speeches that would rarely make the news, though those of various cabinet officials did, speeches to keep faithful the party faithful, speeches to float new ideas, usually bad ones, and rarely his own, and wait for lightning to strike himself instead of the president. Today he was going out to talk about the need to raise taxes to pay for the peace in the Middle East. What a marvelous political opportunity, he thought. Roger Durling would outline the need for new taxes in St. Louis before a convention of purchasing managers, and he was sure the applause would be deafening. But he had accepted the job, had given his word to perform the duties of the office, and if he did any less, then what would he be?
The aircraft rolled unevenly past the hangars and various aircraft, including NEACP, the 747 configured as the National Emergency Airborne Command Post, known as NECAP, or more dramatically as the Doomsday Plane. Always within 2 flying hours of wherever the president might be, a real headache when the president visited Russia or China, it was the only safe place the president might occupy in a nuclear crisis. But that didn't really matter anymore, did it? Durling saw people shuffling in and out of the aircraft. Funding hadn't been reduced on that yet. Well, it was part of the president's personal fleet, and it was still kept ready for a rapid departure. He wondered how soon that might change. Everything else had.
We're ready for departure. All buckled, sir, the sergeant attendant asked.
You bet. Let's get this show on the road, Durling replied with a smile. On Air Force One, he knew, people often showed their confidence in the aircraft and the crew by not buckling. More evidence that his airplane was second best, but he could hardly growl at the sergeant for being a pro, and to this man Roger Durling was important. The vice president reflected that this made the Sergeant E6 in the U.S. Air Force a more honorable man than most of the people in politics. But that wasn't much of a surprise, was it?
That's a Roger.
Again? Ryan asked.
Yes, sir, the voice on the other end of the phone said.
Okay, give me a few minutes.
Yes, sir.
Ryan finished off his coffee and walked off toward Cabot's office. He was surprised to see Goodley in there again. The youngster was keeping his distance from the director's cigar smoke, and even Jack thought that Marcus was overdoing the Patton Act, or whatever the hell Cabot thought he was trying to look like.
What is it, Jack?
Camelot, Jack replied with visible annoyance. Those White House pukes have bowed out again. They want me to join in instead.
Well, are you that tied up?
Sir, we talked about that 4 months ago. It's important for the people at the White House to...
The president and his people are busy on some things. The DCI explained tiredly.
Sir, these things are scheduled weeks in advance, and it's the 4th straight time that...
I know, Jack.
Ryan stood his ground.
Director, somebody has to explain to them how important this is.
I've tried, damn it,
Cabot shot back. He had done so, Jack knew. Have you tried working through Secretary Talbot? Or maybe Dennis Bunker? Jack asked. At least the president listens to them, Jack didn't add. He didn't have to. Cabot got the message.
Look, Jack, we can't give orders to the president. We can only give advice. He doesn't always take it. You're pretty good at this, anyway. Dennis likes playing with you.
Fine, sir, but it's not my job. Do they even read the wash-up notes?
Charlie Alden did. I suppose Liz Elliott does, too.
I bet, Ryan observed icily, ignoring Goodley's presence. Sir, they are being irresponsible.
That's a little strong, Jack.
It's a little true, Director, Ryan said as calmly as he could.
Can I ask what Camelot is? Ben Goodley asked.
It's a game, Cabot answered. Crisis management, usually.
Oh, like Saga and Global?
Yeah, Ryan said. The president never plays. The reason is that we cannot risk knowledge of how he would act in a given situation. And yes, that is overtly Byzantine, but it's always been that way. Instead, the National Security Advisor or some other senior staff member takes his place, and the president is supposed to be briefed on how it goes. Except that President Fowler thinks that he doesn't have to bother, and now his people are starting to act the same dumb way. Jack was sufficiently annoyed that he used the words President Fowler and dumb in the same sentence.
Well, I mean, is it really necessary? Goodley asked.
Sounds like an anachronism to me.
You have car insurance, Ben? Jack asked.
Yes, sure.
Ever have an auto accident?
Not one that was my fault, Goodley replied.
Then why bother with insurance?
Jack answered the question.
Because it's insurance, right? You don't expect to need it. You never want to need it. But because you might need it, you spend the money, or time in this case, to have it.
The presidential scholar made a dismissive gesture.
Come on, it's a different thing altogether.
That's right. In a car, it's just your ass. Ryan stopped the sermon.
Okay, Director, I'm off for the rest of the day.
Your objections and recommendations are noted, Jack. I will bring them up at my first opportunity. Oh, before you leave, about Nitaka?
Ryan stopped in his tracks and stared down at Cabot.
Sir,
Mr. Goodley is not cleared for that word, much less that file.
We are not discussing the substance of the case. When will the people downstairs,
Ryan was grateful he didn't say Mercury,
be ready for the, modified operations? I want to improve data transfer.
6 weeks. Until then, we have to use the other methods we discussed. The Director of Central Intelligence nodded.
Very well. The White House is very interested in that, Jack.
Good job to all concerned.
Glad to hear that, sir.
See you tomorrow. Jack walked out.
Nitaka? Goodley asked after the door closed. Sounds Japanese.
Sorry, Goodley. You can forget that word at your earliest opportunity.
Cabot had spoken it only to remind Ryan of his place, and the honorable part of the man already regretted having done so.
Yes, sir. May I ask an unrelated question?
Sure.
Is Ryan as good as people say?
Cabot stuffed out the remains of his cigar, to the relief of his visitor.
He's got quite a record.
Really?
I've heard that. You know, that's the whole reason I'm here, to examine the personality types that really make a difference. I mean, how does someone grow into the job? Ryan's skyrocketed up the ladder here. I'd be very interested in seeing how he managed to do that.
He's done it by being right a lot more often than he's wrong, by making some tough calls, and with some field jobs that even I can hardly believe.
Cabot said after a moment's consideration.
And you can never, ever reveal that to anyone, Dr. Goodley.
I understand, sir.
Could I see his record, his personnel file?
The DCI's eyebrows arched. Everything you see in there is classified. Anything you try to write about it.
Excuse me, but I know that, sir. Everything I write is subject to security review. I signed off on that. It's important that I learn how a person really fits in here, and Ryan would seem to be an ideal case study for examining how that process happens. I mean, that's why the White House sent me over here, Goodley pointed out. I'm supposed to report to them on what I find.
Cabot was silent for a moment.
I suppose that's okay, then.
Ryan's car arrived at the Pentagon's river entrance. He was met by an Air Force One star and conducted inside, bypassing the metal detector. 2 minutes later, he was in one of many subterranean rooms that lie under and around this ugliest of official buildings.
Hello, Jack, Dennis Bunker called from the far end of the room.
Mr. Secretary? Jack nodded as he took his National Security Advisor's chair. The game started immediately.
What seems to be the problem?
Aside from the fact that Liz Elliott has decided not to grace us with her presence, the Secretary of Defense chuckled, then went serious. There has been an attack on one of our cruisers in the Eastern Med. The information is still sketchy, but the ship has been severely damaged and may be sinking. We presume heavy casualties.
What do we know? Jack asked, settling into the game. He put on a color-coded name tag that identified which part he was playing. A card hanging from the ceiling over his chair had the same purpose.
Not much. Bunker looked up as a Navy lieutenant entered the room. Sir, USS Kidd reports that Valley Forge exploded and sank 5 minutes ago as a result of the initial damage. There are no more than 20 survivors, and rescue operations are underway.
What is the cause of the loss? Ryan asked.
Unknown, sir. Kidd was 30 miles from Valley Forge at the time of the incident. Her helo is on the scene now. Commander 6th Fleet has brought all his ships to full alert status. USS Theodore Roosevelt is launching aircraft to sweep the area.
I know the CAG on TR, Robbie Jackson, Ryan said to nobody in particular.
Not that it mattered.
Theodore Roosevelt was actually in Norfolk, and Robbie was still preparing for his next cruise. The names in the war game were generic, and personal knowledge of the players didn't matter since they were not supposed to be real people. But if it were real, Robbie was Commander Air Group on USS Theodore Roosevelt, and his would be the first plane off the cats. It was well to remember that though this might be a game, its purpose was deadly serious.
Background information? Jack asked. He didn't remember all of the pre-brief on the scenario being played out.
CIA reports a possible mutiny in the Soviet Union by Red Army units in Kazakhstan, and disturbances in 2 Navy bases there also, the game narrator, a Navy commander, reported.
Soviet units in the vicinity of Valley Forge? Bunker asked.
Possibly a submarine, the naval officer answered.
Flash message, the wall speaker announced. USS Kidd reports that it has destroyed an inbound surface-to-surface missile with its close-in weapons system. Superficial damage to the ship, no casualties.
Jack walked to the corner to pour himself a cup of coffee. He smiled as he did so. These games were fun, he admitted to himself. He really did enjoy them. They were also realistic. He'd been swept away from a normal day's routine, dumped in a stuffy room, given confused and fragmented information, and had no idea at all what the hell was supposed to be going on. That was reality. The old joke. How do crisis managers resemble mushrooms? They're kept in the dark and fed horse shit.
Sir, we have an incoming hotline message.
Okay, Ryan thought. It's that kind of game today.
The Pentagon must have come up with the scenario. Let's see if it's still possible to blow the world up.
More concrete? Kati asked.
Much more concrete, Fromm answered. The machines each weigh several tons, and they must be totally stable. The room must be totally stable and totally sealed. It must be clean like a hospital. No, much better than any hospital you have ever seen.
Fromm looked down at his list.
Not cleaner than a German hospital, of course.
Next, electrical power. We'll need 3 large backup generators and at least 2 UPSs.
What? Kati asked.
Uninterruptible power supplies, Gon translated. We'll keep one of the backup generators turning at all times, of course.
Correct, Fromm answered. Since this is a primitive operation, we'll try not to use more than one machine at a time. The real problem with electricity is ensuring a secure circuit. So, we take the line current through the UPSs to protect against spikes. The computer systems on the milling machines are highly sensitive.
Next, Fromm said. Skilled operators.
That will be highly difficult, Gon observed. The German smiled, amazing everyone present.
Not so. It will be easier than you think.
Really? Kati asked. Good news from this infidel.
We'll need perhaps 5 highly trained men, but you have them in the region, I am sure.
Where? There is no machine shop in the region that...
Certainly there is. People here wear spectacles, do they not?
But, of course,
Gon said, rolling his eyes in amazement. The degree of precision you see, Fromm explained to Kati, is no different from what is required for eyeglasses. The machines are very similar in design, just larger. And what we are attempting to do is simply to produce precise and predictable curves in a rigid material. Nuclear bombs are produced to exacting specifications. So are spectacles. Our desired object is larger, but the principle is the same, and with the proper machinery it is merely a matter of scale, not of substance.
So, can you obtain skilled lens makers?
I don't see why not, Kati replied, hiding his annoyance.
They must be highly skilled, Fromm said like a schoolmaster. The best you can find, people with long experience, preferably with training in Germany or England.
There will be a security problem, Gon said quietly.
Oh?
Why is that? Fromm asked with a feigned bafflement that struck both of the others as the summit of arrogance.
Quite so, Kati agreed. Next, we need sturdy tables on which to mount the machines.
Halfway point, Lieutenant Commander Walter Claggett told himself. In 45 more days, USS Maine would surface outside Juan de Fuca Straits, link up with the tugboat, and follow Little Toot into Bangor, where she would then tie up and begin the handoff process to the Blue Crew for the next deterrence patrol cycle. And not a moment too soon. Walter Claggett, friends called him Dutch, a nickname that had originated at the Naval Academy for a reason he no longer remembered. Claggett was black, was 36 years old, and it had been made known to him before sailing that he was being deep-dipped for early selection to commander and had a chance for an early crack at a fast-attack boat. That was fine with him. His 2 attempts at marriage had both ended in failure, which was not uncommon for submariners. Thankfully, there were no kids involved in either union, and the Navy was his life. He was just as happy to spend all of his time at sea, saving his carousing time for those not really brief intervals on the beach. To be at sea, to slide through black water in control of a majestic ship of war, that was the best of all things to Walter Claggett. The company of good men, respect truly earned in a most demanding profession, the acquired ability to know every time what the right thing to do was, the relaxed banter in the wardroom, the responsibility he had to counsel his men. Claggett relished every aspect of his career. It was just his commanding officer he couldn't stand. How the hell did Captain Harry Ricks ever make it this far? He asked himself for the 20th time this week. The man was brilliant. He could have designed a submarine reactor system on the back of an envelope, or maybe even in his head during a rare daydream. He knew things about submarine design that electric boats, shipwrights had never even thought about. He could discuss the ins and outs of periscope design with the Navy's chief optics expert, and knew more about satellite navigation aids than NASA or TRW or whoever the hell was running that program.
Surely he knew more about the guidance packages on their Trident II D-5C launched ballistic missiles than anyone this side of Lockheed's Missile Systems Division. Over dinner 2 weeks earlier, he'd recited a whole page from the maintenance manual. From a technical point of view, Rix might have been the most thoroughly prepared officer in the United States Navy. Harry Rix was the quintessential product of the nuclear Navy. As an engineer, he was unequaled. The technical aspects of his job were almost instinctive to him. Claggett was good and knew it. He also knew that he'd never be as good as Harry Rix.
"It's just that he doesn't know dick about submarining or submariners," Claggett reflected bleakly. It was incredible, but true, that Rix had little feeling for seamanship and none at all for sailors.
"Sir," Claggett said slowly, "this is a very good chief. He's young, but he's sharp."
"He can't keep control of his people," Rix replied.
"Captain, I don't know what you mean by that. His training methods aren't what they're supposed to be. He is a little unconventional, but he has cut 6 seconds off the average reload time. The fish are all fully functional, even the one that came over from the beach bad. The compartment is completely squared away. What more can we ask of the man?"
"I don't ask. I direct. I order. I expect things to be done my way, the right way. And they will be done that way," Rix observed in a dangerously quiet voice. It made no sense at all to cross the skipper on issues like this, especially when he posed them in this way, but Claggett's job as executive officer was to stand between the crew and the captain, especially when the captain was wrong.
"Sir, I must respectfully disagree. I think we look at results, and the results here are just about perfect. A good chief is one who stretches the envelope, and this one hasn't stretched it very far. If you slap him down, it will have a negative effect on him and his department.
X, I expect support from all my officers, and especially from you."
Claggett sat straight up in his chair as though from a blow. He managed to speak calmly.
"Captain, you have my support and my loyalty. It is not my job to be a robot. I'm supposed to offer alternatives. At least," he added, "that's what they told me at PXO school."
Claggett regretted the last sentence even before it was spoken, but somehow it had come out anyway. The CO's cabin was quite small, and immediately got smaller still.
"That was a very foolish thing to say, Lieutenant Commander Walter Martin Claggett," Rix thought with a blank look.
"Next, the reactor drills," Rix said.
"Another one? So soon? For Christ's sake, the last one was friggin' perfect."
"Almost perfect," Claggett corrected himself. "The kids might have saved 10 or 15 seconds somewhere." The executive officer didn't know where that might have been, though.
"Proficiency means every day, X."
"Indeed it does, sir. But they are proficient. I mean, the Oris we ran right before Captain Roselli left missed setting the squadron record by a whisker, and the last drill we ran beat that.
No matter how good drill results are, always demand better. That way you always get better.
Next, Oris, I want the squadron record, X."
"He wants the Navy record. The world record, maybe even a certificate from God," Claggett thought. "More than that, he wants it on his record."
The growler phone on the bulkhead rattled. Rix lifted it.
"Commanding officer."
"Yes, on the way." He hung up. "Sonar contact." Claggett was out the door in 2 seconds, the captain right behind him.
"What is it?"
Claggett asked first. As executive officer, he was also the approach officer for tactical engagements.
"Took me a couple minutes to recognize it," the leading sonar man reported. "Real fluky contact. I think it's a 688 bearing about 195. Direct path contact, sir."
"Playback," Rix ordered. The sonar man took over another screen. He's had grease pencil marks on it, and he didn't want to remove those yet, and ran the display back a few minutes.
"See here, Captain? Real fluky.
Right about here it started firming up. That's when I called in. The captain stabbed his finger on the screen. You should have had it there, petty officer. That's 2 minutes wasted. Pay closer attention next time.
Aye, aye, Captain.
What else could a 23-year-old sonar man second class say? Ricks left the sonar room. Claggett followed, patting the sonar operator on the shoulder as he went.
God damn it, Captain.
Course 270, speed 5, depth 500 even. We are under the layer, the officer of the deck reported. Holding contact Sierra 11 at bearing 195, broad on the port beam. Fire control tracking party is manned. We have fish in tubes 1, 3, and 4. Tube 2 is empty for service. Doors closed, tubes dry. Tell me about Sierra 11, Ricks ordered. Direct path contact. He's below the layer, range unknown. Environmental conditions? Flat calm on the roof, a moderate layer at about 100 feet. We have good isothermal water around us. Sonar conditions are excellent. First read on Sierra 11 is over 10,000 yards. It was Ensign Shaw on the tracking party. Con, sonar, we evaluate contact Sierra 11 as a definite 688 class, U.S. fast attack. I can guesstimate speed at about 14-15 knots, sir.
Whoa, Claggett observed to Ricks. We picked up a Los Angeles at 10K plus. That's gonna piss somebody off.
Sonar, Con, I want data, not guesses, Ricks said.
Captain, he did well to pick that contact out of the background, Claggett said very quietly.
Summer in the Gulf of Alaska meant fishing boats and baleen whales, both in large numbers, making noise and cluttering up sonar displays. That's one hell of a good sonar man in there. We pay him to be good, X. We don't award medals for doing an adequate job. I want to play back later to see if there might have been a sniff earlier that he missed.
Anybody can find something on playback, Claggett thought to himself.
Con, sonar, I'm getting a very faint blade count. Seems to indicate 14 knots, plus or minus one, sir.
Very well. That's better, sonar.
Captain, maybe a little closer than 10,000. Not much, but a little. Track is firming up. Best estimate now, 9,500 yards, course roughly 305, Shaw reported next, waiting for the sky to fall.
So he's not over 10,000 yards off now?
No, sir. Looks like 9,500.
Let me know when you change your mind again, Ricks replied. Drop speed to 4 knots.
Reduce speed 4 knots, aye, the OOD acknowledged.
Let him get ahead of us? Claggett asked.
Yep, the captain nodded. We have a firing solution, the weapons officer said. The XO checked his watch. It didn't get much better than this.
Very well. Glad to hear it, Ricks replied.
Speed is now 4 knots.
Okay, we have him.
Sierra 11 is at bearing 201, range 9100 yards, course 300, speed 15.
Dead meat, Claggett said.
Of course he's making it easy by going that fast.
True enough. This will look good on the patrol report.
That's tricky, Ryan observed. I don't like the way this is going.
Neither do I, Bunker agreed. I recommend weapons release to the TR battle group.
I agree, and will so advise the president.
Ryan placed the call. Under the rules for this game, the president was supposed to be on Air Force One, somewhere over the Pacific, returning from an unspecified country on the Pacific Rim. The president's decision-making role was being played by a committee elsewhere in the Pentagon. Jack made his recommendation and waited for the reply.
Only in self-defense, Dennis.
Bullshit, Bunker said quietly. He listens to me. Jack grinned.
I agree, but not this time.
No offensive action. You may act only to defend the ships in the group. The SecDef turned to the action officer.
Forward that to Theodore Roosevelt. Tell them I expect full combat air patrols. Anything over 200 miles I want reported to me. Under 200, the battle group commander is free to act at discretion. For submarines, the bubble radius is 50 miles. Inside that, prosecute to kill.
That's creative, Jack said.
We have that attack on Valley Forge. The best estimate at the moment was that it had been a surprise missile attack from a Soviet submarine. It appeared that some units of the Russian fleet were acting independently, or at least under orders not emanating from Moscow. Then things got worse. Hotline message. There has just been a ground force attack on a strategic rocket regiment, SS-18 base in Central Asia. Launch all the ready bombers right now. Jack, tell the president that I just gave the order. Comlink failure, the wall speaker said. Radio contact with Air Force One has been interrupted. Tell me more, Jack demanded. That's all we have, sir. Where's the vice president now? Ryan asked. He's aboard Kneecap Alternate, 600 miles south of Bermuda. Kneecap Prime is 400 miles ahead of Air Force One, preparing to land in Alaska for the transfer.
Close enough to Russia that an intercept is possible, but not likely. Have to be a one-way mission, Bunker thought aloud. Unless they strayed over a Soviet warship with SAMs.
Vice President is temporarily in charge.
Sir,
That's my call to make, Jack. The President is either out of the loop or has had his comlinks compromised. SecDef says that the Vice President is in charge until the comlinks are reestablished and validated by code word authentication. Forces are now at DEFCON 1 on my authority.
One thing about Dennis Bunker, Ryan thought. The man never stopped being a fighter jock. He makes decisions and sticks to them. He was usually right, too, as he was here.
Ryan's file was a thick one, almost 5 inches, Goodley saw in the privacy of his seventh-floor cubbyhole. Half an inch of that was background and security clearance forms. The academic record was fairly impressive, especially his doctoral work in history at Georgetown University. Georgetown wasn't Harvard, of course, but it was a fairly respectable institution, Goodley told himself. His first agency job had been as part of Admiral James Greer's junior varsity program, and his first report, Agents and Agencies, had dealt with terrorism. Odd coincidence, Goodley thought, given what had happened later. The documents on Ryan's encounter in London occupied 30 double-space pages, mainly police report summaries and a few news photos. Goodley started making notes. Cowboy, he wrote, first of all. Running into things like that. The academic shook his head. 20 minutes later, he read over the executive summary of Ryan's second CIA report, the one which confidently predicted that the terrorists would probably never operate in America, delivered days before the attack on his family.
Guessed wrong there, didn't you, Ryan?
Goodley chuckled to himself. As bright as they said he was, he made mistakes like everyone else. He'd made a few while working in England, too. He hadn't predicted Chernenko's succession of Andropov, though he had predicted Narmonov was the coming man well in advance of nearly everyone, except Kantrowitz up at Princeton, who'd been the first to see star quality in Andrei Ilyich. Goodley reminded himself that he'd been an undergraduate then, betting that girl at Wellesley, Deborah Frost. Wonder whatever happened to her.
Son of a bitch, Ben whispered a few minutes later. Son of a bitch.
Red October, a Soviet ballistic missile submarine. Defected. Ryan was one of the first to suspect it. Ryan, an analyst at London Station, had run the operation at sea. Killed a Russian sailor. That was the cowboy part again. Couldn't just arrest the guy. Had to shoot him down like something in a movie.
God damn. A Russian ballistic missile defected, and they kept it quiet.
Oh, the boat was later sunk in deep water. Back to London after that for a few more months before rotating home to be Greer's special assistant and heir apparent. Some interesting work with the arms control people.
That can't be right. The KGB chairman was killed in a plane crash.
Goodley was taking furious notes now,
Liz Elliott could not have known any of this, could she? You're not looking for good stuff about Ryan, the White House fellow reminded himself. Elliot had never really said that, of course, but she had made herself clear in a way that he'd understood. Or thought he'd understood, Goodley corrected himself. He suddenly realized just how dangerous a game this might be. Ryan kills people. He'd shot and killed at least three. You didn't get that from talking to the man. Life wasn't a Western. People didn't carry revolvers with notches cut in the handles. Goodley didn't feel a chill over his skin, but he did remind himself that Ryan was someone to be regarded warily. He'd never before met someone who had killed other men, and was not foolish enough to regard such people as heroic or somehow more than other men, but it was something to keep in mind, wasn't it? There were blank spots around the time of James Greer's death, he noted. Wasn't that the time when all that stuff was happening down in Columbia? He made some notes. Ryan had been acting DDI then, but just after Fowler took over, Judge Arthur Moore and Robert Ritter had retired to make way for the new presidential administration, and Ryan had been confirmed by the Senate as Deputy Director of Central Intelligence. So much for his work record. Goodley closed that portion and opened up the personal and financial side. Bad call, Ryan said, 20 minutes too late. I think you're right. Too late. What did we do wrong?
I'm not sure, Bunker replied. Tell the TR group to disengage and pull back, maybe? Ryan stared at the map on the far wall. Maybe. But we've backed Andrei Ilyich into a corner. We have to let him out. How? How do we do that without cornering ourselves?
I think there was a problem with this scenario. Not sure what, though.
Let's rattle his cage hard, Ricks thought aloud.
Like how, Captain? Claggett asked.
Status on Tube 2?
Empty. It was down for maintenance inspection, the weapons officer replied.
Is it okay?
Yes, sir. Completed the inspection half an hour before we got the contact.
Okay, Ricks grinned. I want a water slug out of Tube 2. Let's give him a real launch transient to wake him up.
Damn, Claggett thought.
It was almost something Mancuso or Roselli would have done. Almost.
Sir, that's kind of a noisy way to do it. We can shake him up enough with a tango call on the Gertrude.
Weps, we have a solution on Sierra 11.
Mancuso wants aggressive skippers? Well, I'll show him aggressive.
Yes, sir, the weapons officer snapped back at once. Firing point procedures. Prepare to fire a water slug on Tube 2.
Sir, I confirm torpedo Tube 2 is empty. Weapons in Tubes 1, 3, and 4 are secure.
A call was made to the torpedo room to reconfirm what the electronic displays announced. In the torpedo room, the chief made a look through the small glass port to make certain that they wouldn't be launching anything.
Tube 2 is empty by visual inspection. High-pressure air is online, the chief called over the communications circuit. We are ready to shoot.
Open outer door.
Open outer door, aye. Outer door is open.
Weps.
Locked in. Match generated bearings, and
shoot. The weapons officer pushed the proper button. USS Maine shuddered with the sudden pulse of high-pressure air out of the torpedo tube and into the sea. Aboard USS Omaha, 6,000 yards away, a sonar man had been trying for the past few minutes to decide if the trace on his screen was something other than clutter when a dot appeared on the screen.
Con, sonar, transient, transient, mechanical transient bearing 088 dead aft.
What the hell? The officer of the deck said. He was the boat's navigator in the third week of duty in the new post.
What's back there? Transient, transient. Launch transient bearing 088. I say again, launch transient dead aft.
All ahead flank, the suddenly pale lieutenant said a touch too loudly.
Battle stations, stand by the 5-inch room.
He lifted the command phone for the captain, but the general alarm was already sounding, and the commanding officer ran barefoot into the attack center, his coveralls still open.